Okay, we are still in Nehemiah. No telling how long we will be here. But you can go ahead and open up to Nehemiah. It's before Job, before Esther, before Psalm. And just a note about, once again, about when we study the Old Testament, it's a little different than studying the Old Testament before the New Testament came along. As we study the Old Testament, we can impose upon the Old Testament, overlay, if you would, truths from the New Testament. And just like Ken shared the story from 2 Chronicles today, that's not over-spiritualizing the text to apply it to spiritual matters. That's a very legitimate thing to do in understanding the Word. So, when we do that today, we explain this pretty much every week, but just to remind you, and we won't go into detail about it now, but the writers of the New Testament, they did it often in the New Testament, to where now when we read the Old Testament, there's even a greater and deeper understanding. When you read about the temple, the tabernacle, you can, oh wow, it comes alive now. When you read about the sacrificial system and the priest, you see, wow, that lamb, even all the way back to Abel, sacrificing that lamb, saying, God, take this death of this lamb instead of me. That understanding of a substitute, those types of things, the Old Testament comes alive. And even now, in studying something like Nehemiah and building the wall, there are many applications. Now, we can't do this without discretion, but to apply these truths in a New Testament fashion it's a legitimate and okay thing to do. And if you want more information about that, we can sit down and talk about it. Okay, here just as a quick review. You know, we had Israel as a nation, disobedient, warned by the prophets over and over. Israel, the northern 10 tribes, taken into captivity, 722 B.C. Around 100 years later, the Judah, the southern two tribes, are taken into captivity by Babylon. So, you remember in those days, when an enemy would capture a city, a nation, they would deport them, take them back to their country, so that they would not really have any chance of gaining strength again and overcoming them. So, they marched the 4 or 5 month march from Jerusalem. And if you read the book of Lamentations, that's what the book of Lamentations is about. It's lamenting about what has happened to them. Really, they're repenting on the way too. They're acknowledging their sin and their wrong and that God was just and right in punishing them. So, and it was prophesied that they would spend 70 years in Babylon. And so, all this is prophesied. When they come closer to the time, they realize, if you're in the book of Daniel, they realize the time is close and that it's about time to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the city. Now, it's not going to be the same glory that it was before. They're not going to be the nation that they were, at least not in the near future. And so in 538, they were deported in three ways. They were brought back in three ways. So Zerubbabel led the first one in 538. Ezra, a priest, led the next one in 458. And then a few years later in 445 B.C., Nehemiah is going to lead a group to come back to Jerusalem. So they're already back in Jerusalem. They've already rebuilt the temple. But as we discussed, the walls were dilapidated. And this was not just about physical protection. This was about who they were as God's people. And that they were not really a people without a wall around the city, both in a spiritual sense and in a physical sense. So, Nehemiah, cupbearer to the king. He has a good life. He has some notoriety. And he gets word. His brother brings him word from Jerusalem of what's going on in Jerusalem, that the people are not doing well, and they've not, it's been 100 years or so, they've not rebuilt the wall yet. Something's terribly wrong. And Nehemiah's response to this is that he mourns, he weeps, and he prays to God. He is distraught by the fact that the condition of the wall. You see, he heard about the condition of the wall, and Nehemiah understood and knew God's purposes. He knew it was God's purpose for Jerusalem again to be rebuilt, for the temple to be rebuilt, and for there to be a wall. He was distraught, not because he wasn't getting his way or things weren't going well. He was distraught because God's purposes were not being lived out. And this is key to understanding Nehemiah, the man Nehemiah and the book of Nehemiah. He heard about the condition of the wall, and he was willing to, and he knew God's purposes. He knew it was not God's will and God's purpose for those walls to stay broken down. He was willing to take these purposes to heart and make them his purposes, even to the point that it messed up his good life. Cupbearer to the king. He had a good life, good food, a palace. He had it made. But he was willing to take on God's purposes to the point that it messed all this up. So, really, a lot of what we're looking at today, we're going to look at the actual rebuilding of the wall today. But you have to ask yourself this question, does the condition of the wall concern me? Does the condition of the wall, what is God's purpose? What's God's purpose for His body, for the church? Does the condition of the church concern you? What's God's purpose for your family? What's God's purpose for your friends, for your extended family, for the people around you? If they are not in God's purpose, does it concern you to the point that it concerned Nehemiah? Remember, he fasted and prayed and wept for 3 days. And he sought God's face. What do I do? What do I do, God? And then when he knew, give me the strength to do it, God. And this was Nehemiah's response to the condition of the wall. He was a man of purpose, is what we looked at. He was not a man of his own purpose. He was a man of God's purpose. He had counted the cost. You remember we looked at that example that Jesus, the parable that Jesus had given about when you go to build a tower, you count the cost of the tower. You consider, am I going to be able to build this thing? Am I going to have the finances to do it? Jesus' point was not count the cost to live for me, and if you can't do it, then just do what you can. His point was be prepared. Count the cost. Because following that parable that he gave, at the end he said, anybody that does not give up their life for me is not worthy to be my disciple. If you don't die daily, basically, what we were talking about earlier. What he was saying, you see, a lot of people look at that, count the cost, and they consider. Count the cost of being fully available to God. Well, if I was fully, absolutely available to God, what might He call me to? Well, let's see. He might call me to go and share with my neighbor. I might could do that. He might call me to move to the Congo. Oh, no, I couldn't do that. No, I wouldn't be right now. I couldn't do that. Okay, I could do this, though. That's not what he means by count the cost. Consider what God might ask of you. Consider it all and make yourself fully and absolutely available to Him. Think it through and say, yes, Lord, yes, I am available. Send me. That's what he's talking about. There's no, you can just accept being a 50% Christian. That's not in God's plan. It's die to self, live fully for me, or don't come. That was the attitude of Jesus. We have a little trouble taking that attitude today. We're afraid we're going to scare somebody off. And Jesus did not seem to be concerned about that. He laid the truth out there. So Nehemiah had counted the cost, and he had accepted the cost. He gave up his life in Babylon. He took risks. He went back to Jerusalem. And you remember when he got back, he had a plan formulating in his mind. And he did not consult anyone. He already had the word from God. He didn't need to. He knew and understood God's purpose from His word. He knew it was his job to rebuild the wall. Then he took his moonlight ride around the city by horseback. And he examined the wall. And he got a plan in his mind. And the next day, he shared his vision with the people. And he asked them for sacrifice and risk. He asked them to take risk for God. If you've ever been in a leadership position, you know that's a difficult thing to do. That you don't want to ask people to risk anything or they might turn away. He was not afraid to ask for risk and sacrifice. And really what he was asking of them We've got this wall to build. It's God's purpose. You need to get right with God. And then you'll build. That's what he was saying. And a beautiful thing happened. He preached. He laid out a plan. And they responded. And they said, we're in. We're in with both feet and both hands. We will build. That was their response to his sermon. So, that brings us to chapter 3. And as I looked over chapter 3, I said, ugh. Chapter 3 is just a long list of names. Why don't we just skip this one and go to chapter 4 to the good stuff, the opposition. And we can learn from the end. And we're going to get to chapter 4 and we'll learn traits of opposition you will face. You know, I think that maybe we should have this course of everybody when they first become a Christian, they have to go through this course and learn, okay, listen up. You're going to face some opposition. This is not going to all be roses and cream. You're going to face some opposition. And you're going to face even more opposition if you decide you're going to do something and serve God. That's what's coming. Here's the ways that it may come at you. Prepare for it. So it may be a little late. Maybe you've been a Christian a while, but we will get to that. And we'll talk about the opposition. And I wish somebody would have told me this, even just a few years ago. The types of opposition, and to recognize and not be shocked that there's opposition. In fact, you should go, oh, here it comes. Yep, I was expecting this. That really should be our attitude. I was expecting this. I'm not going to get distraught. I'm not going to get angry. I'm not going to get discouraged. This was coming. I was expecting this. So hopefully, and we'll get to that, but that's next week. This week is just this long list of names. And we're going to go through this list. And I looked at this and I said, there is nothing in here. And then I was drawn, you can flip, I was drawn to verse 28 of chapter 3. And that's where each person was to build the wall outside of their own home. They were responsible to build the wall outside of their home. And I thought, okay, that's a good one. I can get something out of that. But the rest of this, I don't know. And I really didn't read it that close. And I said, well, my old buddy Don Landis, I'll go look. Let's see what he got out of it. So I listened to the CD of Don Landis. And I said, oh, man, I need to go back and read closer. This is good. So I went back and I started reading chapter 3 a little bit closer. And I do believe there's something for us here. But you'll have to stay with me. So you'll have to open up to chapter 3 and follow through with me. A little more introduction first. This is basically just a list of names. These are the builders of the wall. A list of names over 2,400 years old. Common people. If you were building the wall, you didn't have, your name would have been on this list. Just common people are here listed 2,400 years ago, and we have their name recorded for us today. What will be written about you? Well, you might say, well, nothing really. Maybe I signed some loan papers or something one time. Oh, I got in the sports page that one time. So that's the only thing that's been written about me. Well, there are some things written about you, and it's strongly insinuated. The flavor we get when the Bible talks about heaven is that there we will find our deeds recorded. Things that we've done in the strength of Christ. We're told that a cool cup of water offered in the name of Christ will not be forgotten. Sideline. Off the track story here. When I was in Venezuela, one time we were walking up this hillside, and there were just these shacks. And it was just, I mean, this was a steep climb, hiking up this sheer rock. And there were these just little shacks everywhere. And I looked over the edge, and way down there, there's this guy, this skinny little guy. He's got this knot, and he's just carving on this log. And it's sort of starting to look like a canoe. I said, and he's just pouring sweat. It's just in the middle of the day. Down there by himself. There's nobody to be seen. So I had a little canteen in my backpack. So I went down there and I walked over to him, and of course, like, we couldn't talk. And I said, so I pulled my water and I just handed him my canteen, and he looked at me. He chugged it down, hands it back to me. I said, see ya. And I went back. And I was walking back. That verse came to my mind. Of course, I've received my word, so I won't get there, but I'll give it up for illustration. That verse came to my mind. A cool cup of water in the name of Jesus will not be forgotten. That a little thing that is done in the strength of Christ will not be forgotten. So I believe that our deeds will be recorded, that we are, books are being written, if you would, and that there will be a story about you, just like there was a story about these people here. In fact, there's other verses that talk about this, that you lay up treasure in heaven. Let's go to this, 1 Corinthians 3, 9-15. I told you we'd be messing with the New Testament a little bit too here. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds, for no one can lay a foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. Now, this is talking about building the kingdom of God. And that's what we're equating this building a wall to. So when we talk about building the kingdom, we talk about building the wall, just think about these things. Think about Acts 2:42. Remember that? You don't have to go there, but it's what the early church was devoted to. The Word. These are the ways we invest. The Word, fellowship, prayer, breaking of bread, remembering the cross, and sharing our faith. And also Matthew 28, it said, go to all nations and preach the gospel, teaching them to obey all I have commanded you, to make disciples. These things are building the wall. And that's what we're gonna relate this to, just like 1 Corinthians did there. We're talking about building up the body of Christ. Now, when Nehemiah challenged them to build the wall, they responded. Now, there would be many temptations to not do God's work in God's way. There was a way to do God's work. There was a job to do, and there was a way to do it. And there were many temptations to get off track with this. For example, in Ezra 4, the opposition came against building the temple, and the opposition was, the first wave of opposition was, hey, that's a good thing you guys are doing. We'll join with you and help you. And Ezra's response was, no, thank you. Zerubbabel's response, I'm sorry, was no, thank you. You don't have any place in this work. So that was a temptation to not do it in God's way. The other thing was they wanted an easier way to go about the work. They were tempted. They were tempted with fear. Their thoughts were, if we build this wall, it's going to be like a lightning rod. It's going to attract too much attention. People are going to think that we're trying to oppose them, and it's just going to make things worse if we build this wall. There was discouragement. There were all these things that came at them to stop them from doing God's work in God's way. But they persevered. So think about the temptations that you may have experienced to bail out. Just to bail out. I've been tempted to bail out since I've come here to Utah, since we started this church. There have been temptations to be honest, there's been temptations to stop doing it God's way and doing it man's way so there's not so much struggle. That has been a legitimate and real temptation for me. Maybe we could do this where it's just not so different. It could blend in more and not be a lightning rod, not cause so much difficulty. Those are the kind of temptations that the builders of the wall were running into, to not do it God's way. Because there's always an easier way, a way out. It's not such a lightning rod for trouble. But they persevered. And we have to count the cost of this. And we will go into more detail about that. But let's talk about the builders. The builders of the wall. Most of these are everyday people. But there's all classes of people that we're going to find out here. So let's go to chapter 3, and we'll just work down through them. Verse 1, Eliashib, and you can just make up any way you want to pronounce these names. I'm sure that my way is right, though. Oh yeah, okay. Thank you, Brian. Eliashib, the high priest and his fellow priests, went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate that dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hannibal. There were six towers and 10 gates, approximately 2.5 miles of wall. Now the towers, you know, were those, that's where the guard, they were taller than the rest of the wall. That's where the guards, you know, they could actually stand up there and they could go on watch and they could even have a, they could have a number of guys up there to protect any attack that might come, and also elevated so they could see the attack before it got closer. And the first guy he talks about here is the high priest. The high priest is going to go out and work. The only problem here is most of these are, most of these are faithful workers. There are a few that are not. And the very first guy we run into here is a traitor. And we'll see about him in, chapter 13, verse 7. We don't find out he's a traitor until we get to chapter 13. The high priest, ouch, a religious leader, a partner to Nehemiah, and he betrays Nehemiah. He becomes a traitor. And that one hurt. We'll talk specifically about that kind of opposition when we get to it. Verse 2. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zachar, son of Imri, built next to them. Jericho, this was not even their city. These men came from Jericho to build. There was no personal benefit to them, but they had a love for God's people and a love for God's place. And here again, we'll find the opposite will be true of opposition. We have to know the difference between, we'll discover what's the difference between true opposition and just someone's ignorance. Ignorance, not like a, just, they're just not aware. We'll look at the difference between what is true opposition. These guys, had a love for God's people and a love for God's place. And they came and they made their personal sacrifice. Nothing to gain personally from this. Let's go to verse 5. We'll read through verse 4 just to get there though. Meremoth, son of Uriah, the son of Haggaz, repaired the next section. Next to him, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, son of Bana, also made repairs. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under the supervisors. These nobles were the rich guys. They stood on the sidelines. Now, that's not the case all the way through this. There's all classes, all sorts of people working together to accomplish this. Their personal cause was above God's cause. That's really, maybe they were just lazy. But there, you see, they had something to gain. They were businessmen. They had something to, they didn't want to have a wall built. That might discourage trade. That might cause people to think they're trying to be separate. So, they just decided not to, their cause was more important to them than God's cause. They were afraid the wall would offend someone. Your own cause could be just about anything. From your own personal home to hobbies to general self-focus or even self-pity that can cause you to put your cause above God's. And some of these things almost stopped the builders, but it did not. Now, these men from Tekoa, there's a place in Georgia called Tekoa. I don't know if it's named after this or not. But these guys from Tekoa were just common people. But they stood in the gap and they did the work even though their leaders were not. So much for the excuse of bad leadership causing you not to do what you're called to do. In fact, they seemed to do double the work expected of them. They did the work of the nobles that were not working. And then in verse 27, you can look over. It says they went to a whole other section of the wall. They did their section in spite of their leaders not helping. And then they went to a whole and built a whole other section of the wall. They did like triple the work that was expected of them. When I read this, I couldn't help but think of Kevin and Carlton building a deck and pouring concrete. I don't know why. That just came to my mind. Of doing extra beyond your own borders. That was good. And I also think of Turkey. we have a responsibility outside of our own door, but we also have a responsibility way on the other side of the city, another wall, that we can, it is legitimate and we're called to work in other places where we can. We'll go down to verse 7. Well, we'll read 6 and 7. The Jeshanah gate was repaired by Joada, son of Peshiah, and Meshullam, son of Besodeah. You can see I practice all these a lot. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Next to them, repairs were made by the men from Gibeon and Mizpah, Melateah of Gibeon, and Jadon of Marathah, places under the authority of the governor of the Trans-Euphrates. These men were the descendants. You remember that group of people when Joshua was first, many years before, was first conquering Canaan. And you remember those guys that tricked Joshua? They lied to him and they said that we're from way far away, make a treaty with us. They lied, they tricked into being protected by Israel. These are men from that place. The builders of the wall included the repentant guilty. Those who were guilty of deceit, coming in a way they shouldn't have come in. Yet they had turned to God, and now they were ready. Now they were ready to serve. These people were. And the other thing is they could have been persecuted from the governor of the Trans-Euphrates. You see, all these places were under Babylon, but you had governors in each little section, and they had a certain amount of power. And you know what power does to people? They want to protect it. They didn't want somebody else. That's why another reason they were going to resist what Nehemiah was doing. Then you had these guys coming from these other places over to help. They're opening themselves up to persecution. So that they were willing to take that risk. God's work outweighed their personal interest is what was going on there. 8 and 9. Uzziel, son of one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section, and Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Raphaiah, son of Hur, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section. You could just skip over. Think about it. These are goldsmith and perfume makers. These are technically skilled workers. These are guys that are not used to getting out there and carrying rough stone and rock in the heat of the day. But they were out there. They were working. And they were carrying rocks. You know, the church, the body, needs people. You see, they could have said, well, we'll wait and we'll do some gold inlaying on the gates and we'll make it look really nice. That's our gifting. And that's good for people. People should work in their giftings in the church. People should work in their interest and in their giftings. But mainly what God needs are people that are available for the work of the kingdom no matter the cost. This was not their thing. Picking up rocks in the hot sun. That was not their thing. They were skilled technicians. But here they were, available to do God's work. Just a note where it talks about the broad wall. In 1971, there was a really thick section of wall that was discovered in Jerusalem, right in this location. That they believe this is the very wall that's talking about that they were working on there. Nehemiah 3:10 here. Adjoining this, Jedaiah, son of Harahmuth, made repairs opposite his house, and Hathras, son of Hashabniah, made repairs next to him. First things first. Maybe these guys couldn't go to the other side of the city for some reason. Maybe it was their health. Maybe they just didn't have the ability to get over there. But they could, and they did, go to work on the wall outside of their own home. There's a strong motivation for that. The wall to protect, that wall would protect their very home if there was attack going on. But first things first, no one was excused from the work. At the least, they needed to do the work outside of their own home. And we'll cover this in more detail, what that means to do the work, to build the wall around your own home in verses 22 to 25. Verse 12. Well, we'll read through and get to there. Joining this, Jedidiah, son of... Oh, we already read that one, didn't we? Verse 11. I told you you'd have to follow along to keep up, right? Malchijah, son of Haram, and Hashub, son of Pathmoab, repaired another section and the Tower of the Ovens. I told you all these, you know, these gates and towers are named by things that go on around there. The ovens of this being a district where the baking is done. The fish gate, you know, where there was the fish market where the men of Tyre from near the Mediterranean would come and sell fish near there. That's where a lot of the names came from. Verse 12, Shalom, son of Haliosh, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. A ruler, again, a ruler, a leader, out toting rocks and building the wall. And not only that, not the norm for this day, his young daughters are out there with him. They're out doing this hard labor. The whole family got out there and did this hard labor together. Remember, building this wall, you remember back in Zerubbabel's day, they were warned by the prophet, they didn't finish the temple because they were just working on their own house. This is different. They were not just working on their own house. They were outside of their house. They were doing God's work, not their own work in this case. And the whole family was out there laboring to do it. Verse 13. The valley gate was repaired by Hanan and the residents of Zanoa. They rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. They also repaired 500 yards of wall. That's a lot. 500 yards of wall as far as the dung gate. They worked according to their ability. And they did not look at the fairness. I'm doing more than this person. That person's not doing as much as me. They just did what they could do according to their ability. These guys could do a lot, so they did a lot. Verse 14. The dung gate was repaired by Malchijah, son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Bethlehem. He rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. They were willing to do the dirty work. Do you remember the dung gate was the gate that led out to the dump? It was also, they believed that this is where the sewer left the city. Sewers were not buried in pipes in the grounds back then, but an open ditch. It was not a pleasant place to work. But they were there doing the dirty work. And they were willing to. And verse 15. The fountain gate was repaired by Shalom, son of Kohazel, ruler of the district of Mizpah. He rebuilt it, roofing it over and putting its doors and bolts and bars in place. He also repaired the wall of the pool of Siloam by the king's garden as far as the steps going down from the city of David. Now, these guys had the nice place to work. They were by the palace, by the gardens. They were overlooking the pools and the fountains. This was a pretty neat place. Had a lot of history here. They were willing to do the glory work. Have you ever heard somebody say, well, I don't want to take the glory and get up front? Well, somebody's got to get up front. You have to be willing to face the temptation of pride. Will there be temptation of pride? It doesn't matter how small a group it is. There's always temptation of pride if you're in a position that is seen. But we have to be willing to do what we're called to do. Whether it's working at the dung gate or whether it's working at the gate by the fountain. Where we're called to do, we must work and face whatever temptations come with that work. We don't say, no, I'm not going to do it because I'll be tempted with pride. Yeah, you will be tempted with pride. But that's what God's calling you to do. Then you respond and you do it. Well, if I write a book, then my name will get... Well, if God's calling you to write a book, then write a book. And let Him use it. And deal with the temptation of pride. Verses 16 and 17. Beyond him, Nehemiah, son of Azbuk, ruler of the half-district of Beth-Sur, made the repairs up to a point opposite the tombs of David as far as the artificial pool and the house of heroes. Next to him, the repairs were made by the Levites under Rehum, son of Bani. Beside him, Heshcham, ruler of the half district of Keilah, carried out repairs for his district. Again, the Levites did not have to work. The Levites could have said, my plate is full. I've got the responsibility of the temple. But yet, they got out there. They went ahead and did the work. The House of Heroes, if you wonder what that is, that kind of caught my attention. That's probably where it's the bunkhouse for David's mighty men. That's where his, you remember that elite fighting group that's most likely where they stayed near the palace when David was king. Little side note. 18 to 21. Next to him, the repairs were made by their country. I never thought I would go through this whole list of people, but here we are. Next to him, the repairs were made by their countryman, Avenus, son of... Did I already read that one? Son of Hedad, ruler of the half-district of Keilah. Next to him, Ezer, son of Jeshua, ruler of Mizpah, repaired another section from a point facing the ascent to the armory as far as the angle. Next to him, Barak, son of Zebra, zealously repaired another section from the angle to the entrance of the house of Elishabib, the high priest. Next to him, Meremoth, son of Uriah, the son of Hakaz, repaired another section from the entrance of Elishabib's house to the end of it. You know, we get something from each one of these builders that tells us really how we should work. And this guy did it, the work, with zeal. Why not work with zeal? To be in step with God, doing His mind and His heart, laying up treasure in heaven, and building for eternity in the strength of Christ. Why not do that with zeal? If we can play softball with zeal, if we can, some of us, even find a job that we like with zeal that we're going to retire from sometime in this life, why not work for something that's going to last for eternity with zeal? Difficult times and opposition, to be sure, but we will prevail if we don't give up. We're promised that. So why not work with zeal? And when I read, for some reason this struck me as loving God more each day. If you're going to work with zeal, your relationship cannot be stagnant. It has to be a relationship of loving God more. Does your love for God grow every day? That should be happening in your life. Your love for God should be growing each day as you abide in Christ. And you should become passionate about what He is passionate about. You learn what God is passionate about. You take those causes on for yourself, and you will develop a zeal for the very things that are important to God. Should not those things be important to you? It's how you were made to live. You weren't made to get your fulfillment from a job, as much as we try to do that. You were not made to get to be fulfilled through a relationship, as much as we try to do that and put that pressure on another person. We were made to get our fulfillment from being in step with God, being in line with Him, and having fellowship with Him. And that means taking on His purpose. The most advantageous thing that I can come up with, this overwhelms me at times, to take on God's purpose, to minister to others, to reach out to others, to someone that doesn't know Him, or to the body, to equip, to build up. You see, that's God's desire to do those things. When that becomes my desire, I get this taste of God, what He thinks and what He feels and what He's like. And that's the joy of doing God's work. It's not somehow somebody says thank you and that makes you feel good. It's being in step with God. It's knowing what He loves. It's knowing what He hates. And it's to feel what God feels, to know what God knows, to an extent. That brings intimacy with Him. As we labor building the wall, it should bring intimacy with God, and that's where the joy of the labor lies. So if we're just doing it in our own strength, if we're just doing it to look good, if we're just doing it to get points, those things don't happen. But if we're doing it to know Him, and to be in line with Him, then there's joy in the labor. And you know, this is where Nehemiah was. He had God's purposes. And Nehemiah's prayer, ever since we studied that, that has impacted me. And I have, this is always on my mind, this was on my mind before, but since Nehemiah, that little tiny example where he went before the king said, "What's wrong, Nehemiah? What can I do for you?" And Nehemiah said, "Oh God, guide me in what I say." I've been making that more than ever a practice. God, guide me in what I say. Guide me in what I think. What now, God? What now? That continual dependence on Him of praying without ceasing. Verse 22 to 25. The priest next to him, the repairs next to him were made by the priest from the surrounding region. Beyond them, Benjamin and Hasab made repairs in front of their house. And next to them, Hasar, son of Maaseiah, son of Anna, made repairs beside his house. Next to him, Benua, son of Henadad, repaired another section from Azariah's house to the angle and the corner. And Palal, son of Uzziah, worked opposite the angle and the tower projecting from the upper palace near the court of the guard. Next to him, Fadiah, sons of Parash. Again, the wall in front of their own house. It is so obvious here that we cannot just be caught up into our own lives, paneling our own houses, as the prophet said in Zerubbabel's day. In front of your own house, your own local body, this own little body that you are a part of, investing in that, your own circle. There are other parts to your calling for sure. There are other parts around the world that you may very likely be called to. But this is absolutely sure. This is a must. We don't isolate ourselves from the world or stop with just discipling our immediate family, your circle, your extended family, your work associates, your neighbors, the people you see in your kids' activities. You can't forget this as we talk about this, though. Your driving force must be God's purposes. God's purposes are your driving force, not your own. The wall outside of your house is your circle. You see, I cannot go and impact the people that you can impact. I can't. I cannot jump into your shoes and go to school or go to work or do the things that you do. Nobody else can. Who else can? There's a wall outside of your house that you are responsible for and that nobody else can do. What is your plan to build that wall? It doesn't just happen. Nehemiah surveyed the situation, he saw the conditions, and he made a plan to build the wall. What is your plan to make disciples? If that somehow in some remote form offends you, that doesn't come from me. That comes from Jesus. This is what we're called to do, to make disciples. So what is your plan to make disciples? Now remember, we talked about the Word, fellowship, breaking bread, sharing your faith, prayer. We must all move in this direction. Not just to be equipped, because that's planned for you. To be equipped is basically planned for you in the body. There's Bible studies, there's fellowship. Those things are kind of planned for you. You may struggle with submitting to the plan and saying, "Oh yeah, I'm going to sacrifice and do that." But that plan is basically made for you. But there is a plan that you have to make. You have to think through. I would like for this discussion to be around every single table. Do you guys talk around the table? That's what we do. I would like for that to be around the table of every single family and to be in the thoughts of every single person. The plan to make disciples. What's your plan to go out and build the wall in front of your house this week, the next week, this month? Nehemiah had a plan. It's not wrong to have a plan. Now, it's not easy. We've already talked about that. There's opposition. But what is standing in your way? What is standing in your way to building the wall around your house. The people you are in acquaintance with, even this very body, your extended family, what is God calling you to there, and what's preventing you from doing it? You know, sometimes the good prevents the best. There are a lot of good things you can do to stop you from doing the best thing you could do. Or is personal interest above God's interest, above God's purpose? Or just discouragement. You've tried and you've tried and you've tried and nothing's happened. That was one of the opposition. This was one of the weapons that the opposition carried. And we'll look at that next week. Was they discouraged the builders. That was one of their main things. They wanted to discourage the builders from building. Look at what you're doing. It's worthless. A fox could jump on that wall and knock it down. To discourage. So, is that stopping you from continuing building discouragement? We are told that if we keep on and we persevere, there will be a crop. There will be fruit. Or maybe it's resentment. Anytime. Because we're not in this alone. We work in partnership with the rest of the body. And anytime you work in partnership with another person, resentment can build up. And that keeps us from building the wall. And that's another thing that could happen with the builder. They begin to resent the people building next to them because they weren't doing it exactly like they do it or whatever. And that makes you stay home and not go do what God has called you to do. And we keep coming back to this. But here's how the church is supposed to work. Families and single people thinking like a mini church. What's the call of the church? To go and make disciples. What's the call of every family? To go and make disciples. It is no different. You are not just responsible for making disciples of your own children. That is true. Or encouraging those in your family. Or those closest to you. The focus is not inward, but it's working together with the whole body for God's purposes. We are not to be just consumers, but producers, wall builders. Every single part of the body at some point has to leave their house and go out and work on the wall and build the wall. Verse 28-32. Above the horse gate, the priest made repairs, each in front of his own house. Next to them, Zadok, son of Immer, made repairs opposite his house. Next to him, Shinah, son of Shechaniah, the guard of the east gate, made repairs. Next to him, Hananah, son of Shelemiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zalaphah, repaired another section. Next to him, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, made repairs opposite his living quarters. Next to him, Malchijah, son, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the temple service and the merchants opposite the inspection gate and as far as the room above the corner and between the room above the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmith and merchants made repairs. It was grueling, but we made it through. There was a plan. Do you get this notion? There was a plan to what they were doing. Plan your building and you will build better. And that's not mean to be a hyper planner where you can't do something at the spur of the moment or when opportunities happen that you can't take advantage of that. But you have a general plan and most likely it changes. But we have a plan to build. And I mentioned this to you last week is that Lori and I have been doing this lately. What's up for next week? What are God's purposes for us next week? What would God have us to do this week? Not just letting it happen. But planning for God. I'm telling you, this has been on my heart that if we could ever get the people of the body to change their focus from inward to outward and take on this, just exactly what we're talking about, this is the sign of a healthy church. There's all those seminars about healthy church and all. This is the sign of a healthy church where every family and individual takes on this purpose of the church. Themselves, individually. And they go about their job of making disciples in whatever way that God has called them to do it. So, nothing too terribly exciting in this chapter 3. Mostly just some common people building a wall over 2,400 years ago. Here their names are recorded for us. Yet, when you get a different perspective, an eternal view. That labor of one rock at a time, after a lifetime of laying down rocks, a massive wall is built when viewed with eternal eyes. Have you ever done that? Were you like building a brick wall or something where you're just down working close and you're doing something, and you keep your mind on the task and you're going, then after a while you go, oh man, wow, look at that. And you look back from a different perspective, a little higher, and something has happened. It doesn't seem like it, but you look back and a wall has been built. In eternity, we will get the opportunity to look back and see what our life has been spent for. Did we build a wall that would last when it goes through the test? Was it done in His strength? And was it done with the purposes of God? I hope we'll be able to say, like the New Tribes video, it is good, it is very good. What was the word? Etau. It is good, it is very good. I want to look back at my life and see that it has been a worthwhile labor done in the strength of Christ, and that a wall has been built for eternity. And not just spend my life for earthly things that go away at death.